Hi everyone, and welcome again to the sixth episode in this series of Faith and Feminism. And I'm very privileged to be hosting Reverend Adera. Karibu sana.
Thank you so much.
I do not want to introduce you.
Yeah.
I would love for you to introduce yourself because I find that you know yourself better. So please.
Okay. I don't know what to say about myself because there are so many things to say about myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I will choose three things.
Yes.
My name is Adera Godfrey Owino.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important.
Yes.
I love to be called Adera.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's my African name.
Yes.
It's my grandfather's name, my father's name, and my name.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good name for me. I am a priest in the Anglican Church, but also a theologian.
Mm-hmm.
At St. Paul's University, I'm doing my PhD in theology and gender studies.
Mm-hmm.
My interest is in looking at theology doctrines of the Church of Christianity from a woman's perspective,
mm-hmm.
and looking at how construction of theologies over the years have invisibilized people like women and people in the minority side. And so looking at how then do people at that level of life,
mm-hmm.
speak back, not push mm-hmm. back, but speak back and construct theologies that make sense,
mm-hmm.
and that brings an inclusive conversation about who God is.
Mm.
So that's who I am, and I'm glad to be here. And
mm.
sixth episode, wow.
Yes.
That looks amazing because then it means I am the one laying foundation for the perfect one. The seventh.
The seventh one. This is our final one in this series.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've had conversations, the previous mm-hmm. ones. We've had Bishop Rose Okello and Bishop Emily.
Wow.
So we shot that on location in Kisumu
mm-hmm.
when we were having
mm-hmm.
the Faith and Feminism
mm-hmm.
round table.
Mm-hmm.
So those conversations were amazing.
Wow.
Yes.
Those are big names.
They are big names, and you're a big name as well. But they are names of
yeah.
people who
yeah.
are really
mm-hmm.
in the space
mm-hmm.
and have worked so
mm-hmm.
tirelessly
mm-hmm.
to frontline
mm-hmm.
the conversation on faith and feminism.
Mm-hmm.
You said people on the minority side.
Mm-hmm.
For others, we'll think it's the minority political party. What do you mean?
So, I am a theologian, and most of my conversations today would be theological.
Mm-hmm.
And I begin from the argument that over the years, theology has been constructed.
Mm-hmm.
Constructed is a word, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Because then there is no... Theology doesn't come from a vacuum. It's
mm-hmm.
constructed. It doesn't come from heaven.
Yeah.
It's constructed.
Mm-hmm.
So, theology has been constructed from the side of the privileged,
mm-hmm.
the side of those with the power, the side with of those with the money, the
mm-hmm.
side of those with every kind of privilege.
Yeah.
In that construction, realities of people who did not have that power, that privilege, that space, that platform, were not really taken into consideration for doing theology. I can give an example. For example, missionary theology
mm-hmm.
constructed Africa like they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about African, realities, African
mm-hmm.
aspects of the divine, the way they wanted,
mm-hmm.
basically to justify their claims for civilization, claims
mm-hmm.
for evangelism and everything else.
Yeah.
And so that's the first one. Even from the big time we begin talking about Christianity, theology is constructed from a point of privilege,
mm-hmm.
and that always leaves other people outside that box of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people I've said is Africans were left out from that box.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, we see women have been left outside that box for
mm-hmm.
so long.
Mm-hmm.
And today, in my context, for example, young people, do we listen to young people?
Mm-hmm.
What do they think about who God is?
And yeah.
It's about church and Christianity and faith,
mm-hmm.
about children. And generally, people who do not fit the boxes.
The box.
How
yeah.
do we talk about their theology?
Their theology.
Because then they also have a theology.
Yeah. And I think for me, one of the things that simplified what theology is,
mm.
is that these are God stories
yeah.
and
yeah.
stories of how
mm-hmm.
we speak about God
mm-hmm.
and how God has revealed God's self
yeah.
to
mm-hmm.
us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't wait to explore more about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
But before we go to the conversation of
mm.
the day in its depth,
mm.
maybe just one thing about yourself. What is that one thing that brings you joy
mm.
and a thing that brings you sorrow?
Wow. I didn't think about that.
Yes.
But yeah, one thing that brings me the greatest joy mm-hmm. for me is my peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm in a place where, a state where there's nothing stressing me.
Yeah.
I'm just me. I'm just happy. That gives me joy.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that gives me sadness is when that peace of mind is being attacked
mm-hmm.
by things that don't request me to attack my mm-hmm. peace of mind, or by people, or by situations, or yeah. by opinions, by ideas, ideologies
mm-hmm.
that do that. That yeah. doesn't give me joy. And not just me, even people I see around me, mm-hmm. that somebody just wants to be happy, just
yeah.
wants to enjoy their God-given life, have mm-hmm. life in abundance. And before they know it, something has just happened.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody has just brought something. And so for me, what really makes me sad is that people's peace of mind, people's freedom to be who they are, people's, you know, chance to enjoy life in abundance that mm. is God-given is taken away from them through so many things.
Yeah.
That makes me sad.
Thank you. Yeah, peace of mind is important. Yeah. And actually, we don't realize how much it is until you don't have it.
Yeah.
So we are talking about feminism,
mm.
the F word.
Yes.
So... maybe as you're defining what feminism is, you can tell me, you can tell us how your journey into this feminism conversation and why is a reverend, a male reverend, speaking about feminism?
So I will say four quick things. One, there are so many feminisms
mm-hmm.
and I'm not saying this to begin to put them in tires, that mm-hmm. is one that is special and one that's not special. I'm just mm-hmm. saying there are multiple feminisms based on context,
mm-hmm.
based on time in history.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you would see people talking about first wave, second wave, and all these kind of things. So there mm-hmm. are many feminisms.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but there are fundamental things that they share,
mm-hmm.
which I would use to define feminism for me. So I would say the next three things, like a definition one, feminism for me is an ideology.
Mm-hmm.
It's a framework.
Yeah.
And I'm deliberate on this. A framework of asking the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
Why things are the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
And why other alternatives are mm-hmm. not factored in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a framework of asking the right questions about why things are the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I would say feminism is a movement.
Mm-hmm.
But as a movement, everybody can join.
Yeah.
Males and females, whites and blacks, mm-hmm. Africans and Asians, everybody can do it. It's a movement.
Mm-hmm.
And as a movement, it's a movement that has a particular goal, a goal of challenging norms, narratives, perceptions, structures, systems
mm-hmm.
that organize us by demeaning people, especially mm-hmm. women.
Yeah.
So it's sad that, of course, there are always things organizing our societies.
Mm-hmm.
And so a movement that challenges that organizing of society, that demeans women,
mm-hmm.
for me, it's feminism, and anybody can join that movement.
Mm-hmm.
And as a movement, it's not just about women.
Mm-hmm.
It's about society.
Yeah.
It's about all of us.
Mm-hmm.
What are the norms, narratives, situations, systems that organize us by demeaning others,
mm-hmm.
by excluding others, by making others more privileged and assigning otherness to other people?
Mm-hmm.
Those. Anybody who is fighting and questioning those kind of organization,
mm-hmm.
that person is feminist.
Mm.
And finally, and this could be too radical,
mm-hmm.
but what I like saying so much,
mm.
feminism is spirituality in itself.
Mm.
I would say feminism is an aspect of spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
If spirituality is about what I believe, how I practice, how that connects to my inner self, how
mm-hmm.
that connects to the divine, if that is what spirituality is, then
mm-hmm.
feminism is one of it. Feminism is about a belief that I have that society can be different,
mm.
that spaces can be inclusive, that women can be heard, not just seen and heard, and their perspectives taken into
mm-hmm.
consideration. It's a belief that we have that comes from the divine,
mm.
that all of us are made in the image of the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way I practice that belief
mm.
is through getting into feminist movement,
mm-hmm.
a movement that wants to see all of us having equal spaces,
mm-hmm.
equal chances, and also the way that connects to my inner self, that I would not want to see And I struggle when I put affiliations, I mean, I put relationships to it. People normally say, if it's not your sister, if it's not your mother, I'm like, yeah, no, that doesn't work for me.
It doesn't.
It's simply if it's a human being.
Yes.
And so what I'm saying is, like, what is me as a person should be something that makes me recognize that the other person also is a fully a person like myself.
Yeah.
I don't know how to speak about this, but just to go back to Ubuntu, that we can only be a humans together. My humanness is bound
is
to someone
tied human, to someone else's human.
And so for me, that makes me believe that feminism could also be spirituality. And so as a male priest, why do I come to this space, and why do I use feminist frameworks and lenses, and why do I do join feminist movements? It's because fundamentally, as a man, I recognize as a man that I am born with privilege as a man.
Yeah.
I am born in a society that is patriarchal in its ordering and organization. And that gives me privilege as a man.
Yeah.
I don't mean to say that all men live in the same level. Different things make people live at different spaces. But the fact that you're a man, you get more opportunities, you get more chances, you get more spaces, you get more recognized because that's how society is.
Yeah.
And so I'm born a man. Feminism makes me critical of that privilege that,
of that
I have.
Structure.
And it's sad. It's almost normal that I have them as a man.
Yeah. You know, in the conversation around privilege, there's, I don't know where I, this is how I always say, I don't know where I read it or listened to, that privilege is about the things you don't have to think about. That someone else does. So, like, and this reminds me of a story where we had gone for a meeting and we had invited male and female reverends. All the women reverends were late. The men arrived so much earlier. And so, someone who was next to me kept asking, you see, now this is why women can't be helped. Why are they so late? And then I sat with her and asked her, tell me what these women have to do in their homes before they leave the house. And what these men do before they leave the house. And this, there could be a couple coming to the same event, but the work that the woman has to do before she leaves the house is very different from what, and so those are, that is what we call privilege. That is a very simple example of how privilege works, but it's all of those things that you don't have to think about. For us, when we are sighted people, you don't think about how you're going to catch a matatu. You just go to the road and all that. So I don't need to find someone to hold my hand, get my white stick and all of that. So that is privilege.
And so, and so that's what I'm saying. For me, I get into this space because I want to recognize, I want to know and accept that I'm born with privilege as a man. And it is not the same as other human beings, that my humanness is tied to their human humanness. And so that makes me want to look at things from a lens that disrupt that ordering. And I only find it through a feminist lens. Of course, I know there are many other lenses of looking at things. But for me, this is more palatable within my faith spaces. But also secondly, because as a priest, the promise of the gospel of Christ that we preach to everybody is life in abundance. The promise of Christ is that we are all children of God, regardless of where we come from, regardless of our gender, of who we are all children of God. And so how comes then that they are lesser children of God? How comes that the others who then cannot come to the space of abundant life that Christ promises? There are structures, there are systems that make that a possibility. Sometimes we may not see, but I believe that that kind of thing is enabled by something beyond those people. And it is these kinds of systems and structures. And so as a priest, I want to be concerned that why are people in my congregation, why are others looked at as lesser children of God? Why are others looked at as not full recipients of abundant life? And so I would use a feminist lens then to construct my ministry my pastoral work,
mm-hmm.
so that then people can come to a place where everybody equally receives abundant life that Christ promises.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is recognized and honored as a child of God, having the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody is also gifted by God, empowered by the Holy Spirit equally, such that I would not feel threatened when I am led by a woman bishop.
Yeah.
Because all of us are empowered equally by the Holy Spirit to do the work of God.
Yeah.
So to cut a long story short, is for me to be an effective minister, I have to come to a place of critically reflecting on things that organize us by making others lesser children of God.
Mm.
And it's only feminist lenses that allow
that helps that. In that.
Yeah, yeah.
I am looking for especially with the spiritual lens that you're talking about in the spiritual spaces where there has been texts that have been used and sociocultural conversations where they say that a woman can never lead a man. It's hierarchy. It's so what do you speak, like there are some things when we were doing our community conversations in Kisumu for Kisumu and Vihiga, they were saying that because of culture and the role of a woman generally, when that woman comes and becomes a leader in the church, there are some things that she cannot do. There are sometimes she cannot bury a person. Sometimes she's not allowed to pray for a house when they're moving a house or they're laying a foundation. What is that, the role of culture, how culture interplays in faith? Yes, and some of the beliefs that we have, but also biblical culture, where there are also some some texts that talk about the place of women and their silence and how they are meant to be. So I'd like you to help us explore that for a bit.
Yeah, and I would begin with an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I would look at the camera and say, the Bible says nothing.
Ooh.
We make it say what it says.
Yes, we give meaning to what it says.
What it says. The Bible is written. And having said that, we come to this space by saying that the Bible is important.
Mm-hmm.
We need to take the Bible seriously, but also critically.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, religion generally, Christianity particularly, I would use a word, is a beggar. It has nothing of its own. Lots of times it picks things that it found within a context that then it relates with.
Mm-hmm.
So when Christianity comes to contact with a particular context, there's always a likelihood of Christianity embracing some things there, or Christianity finding a connection with particular things, and then so absorbing them or co-opting them and making them look like it is the word of God, it is Christian. And we know very well that Christianity is born in a Greco-Roman context. And so theologists at that time, narratives at that time, are things that reflect that Greco-Roman context. When it moves to, the Western context, when it goes to Europe, for example, it gets a white color, it gets another mask that is white. And so Christianity looks like it's white then. It looks like everything about Christianity comes from white. Jesus is white, God is white, all these things are white. And then when it comes to Africa, it's brought by the missionaries and they package it using a colonial mindset, a colonial worldview of things. And then so when our forefathers, and thank them for that good work, begins to reimagine Christianity, they go back to culture again. Say our culture was demonized. That our culture was made to look like it had nothing in it. And so they embraced that culture.
And also one of the things before, because we think that there was no Christianity before the missionaries came.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah? So, because a lot of the times, one of the reasons why a lot of people are anti-Christianity is the fact that they say this is white man's religion, yet looking at the Ethiopian church, looking at the Augustine of Hippo, looking at what was happening in North Africa and Ethiopia as well, and the conversations around the faith that was born in this continent. Yeah, so I just wanted, because when you said that it comes, it came and became like the white man, but there's like, also, no, I'm just saying this for context, that the beginnings of Christianity in this continent is not with the white man.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
But then the coloniality of what the white man came made it that they had to connect Christianity with colonialism for it to...
Yeah.
For it to do the work of of the devil of steel.
Of course, Africa is the cradle of many things, not just of humanity, but also the cradle of Christianity. Christianity began in Africa. And as you've said rightly, there was Christianity in Ethiopia. There was Christianity in North Africa, in, you know, the Byzantine kingdom of that time. And there was vibrant Christianity that was happening there. But I'm talking about the Christianity, therefore, that then... the version or the brand that we have in Africa currently is what we would say is one that came with a mask, a colonial mask. But of course, you have to say that that early Christianity was also informed by Greco-Roman sensibilities of that time.
Yeah.
And so that was another mask. And then so there's a mask of colonization, mask of the white man, of the white person. And then it comes and when our forefathers begin to reclaim Christianity, they return back to African culture.
Yeah.
And later on, our African women theologians begin to say returning to culture was very powerful. What happened is there are aspects of culture that we did not pay attention to. What I mean by saying all these things that Christianity is a beggar picking cultures, I want to bring an aspect of how then do we talk about the Bible in all this conversation. The Bible has three contexts that we must recognize. And as I'm saying, the Bible doesn't say anything. The Bible is God's written word, and it's us who make it say what it says. And so the Bible has three contexts. One, there's a context of what I would say in simple terms of the actual occurrence or the actual thing. For example, the Bible... The death of Christ, for example, was not written in the gospel when Christ was dying. It was then way after he had died and had risen, and people then begin to, you know, collect those stories. So there's that context of the real thing that happened. Then there's a context of the writer. So, for example, our brother Paul, or all writers of the Bible, begin to record things they had received through oral tradition. It means their context of writing and what happens is different. Then now there's a context of the reader. And this is broad. The reader, at that time, Paul writing, for example, to the church in Ephesus, the church in Philippi. There's that reader's context. And then also has particular cultures, particular themes at that time. Then now there's me today who's reading the Bible.
Who's a reader as well.
And so I cannot therefore take the Bible literally with all these things happening. Christianity borrowing all these cultures and stories and finding connection with things that exist in those cultures. We cannot therefore take the Bible literally. And we can also ignore the way it interacts with culture and gives meaning to then what is written. And so coming to the text of, for example, what Paul says in many contexts, that women should be silent. And people are using it today that we cannot have women leaders in church or even leaders, there are things they cannot do. I want to suggest to all of us that that's a wrong interpretation of the Bible. Paul was writing in a context, and you must go to that context. What was happening that made Paul write what he wrote? You know, Kenyans are known for making good memes. Recently, there was a meme that we really laughed with my friends, where somebody said, what is the letter written to the Corinthians doing in Kisumu, for example? it was written to someone else.
Yes.
What is doing? Of course, we must read it today. But then we must look at it with the lens of, okay, I am in Kisumu. This was written 2,000, more than 12 years ago to someone else. And so the issue of context is very important as we interpret the Bible. And our African patriarchal sensibilities also find consonance with a patriarchal culture that found its way in the writing of scriptures. And so we think that it's God's requirement that then women should not lead.
Mm-hmm.
That is not true. I invite people to consider all these many contexts mm-hmm. that the Bible has come through for mm-hmm. us to begin to make sense of what it is to our friends mm-hmm. today. So the Bible is important. We must take it importantly. We must take it seriously, but also critically, mm-hmm. not literally.
Yeah. And I remember in Daughters of Anoa,
yeah.
Mama Mercy Amber Oduwe mm-hmm. says that patriarchy, what mm-hmm. patriarchy mm-hmm. does, it collects
yeah.
the best parts yeah. The most yeah. oppressive yeah. parts yeah. of yeah. every culture, mm-hmm. of every text, mm-hmm. everything. And mm-hmm. so it collects them mm-hmm. and makes a
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what has
yeah.
happened
yeah. Yeah.
in especially in churches, in mm-hmm. faith spaces
yeah.
and yeah, in faith spaces where feminism is now, when you're coming into that conversation, yeah, yeah. feminism becomes demonized
mm-hmm.
And it's seen as an enabler.
Yeah.
So feminism, I want to phrase this question yeah, in a yeah. different way, that mm. feminism is demonized mm. in faith spaces, mm. yeah? And then also faith mm. is seen as an enabler of oppression mm. in many mm. feminist spaces.
Mm.
You're a priest,
yeah.
you're an activist. Mm. What story do we need to tell ourselves so as to allow for allyship in these two very powerful movements?
Now, there, and thanks for that question. And I like the bit that, you know, it's so entangled in mm. so many layers mm. that we need to disentangle each layer for mm. us to unpack it. But I want to say three things. The relationship between faith and feminism, I can define it in three words. I can talk about tension, mm. collaboration, mm. and transformation.
Mm.
Tension, as you've raised it, that people look at feminism, feminist lenses, in pathological terms within faith spaces,
mm-hmm.
that it's something that is ungodly.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that is disrupting the order of God.
Mm.
But also, in many feminist spaces, faith is looked at suspiciously.
Mm-hmm.
That it is faith that enables oppression,
mm-hmm.
that enables, you know, a silencing. It is faith that then packages, makes people comfortable with their state that is not really what God wants them to
mm-hmm.
be. And so there's that tension that we must recognize, that there's tension. But why is that? Why is there tension? There's tension because in religious spaces, the act of questioning has not been appreciated.
Mm.
I began by saying feminism is a framework of asking the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
A framework of asking why are things the way they are and why are other possibilities not considered.
Mm-hmm.
And so religion has been packaged in ways that we don't ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't stand there and preach every Sunday, then you say, hey, pastor, I got a question.
Yeah.
And say, you man, don't ask about it.
Yes, like, no questions allowed.
Yes,
there's no Q&A after a sermon.
Yes. So the fact that religion was packaged in ways that denied people a chance to question
mm-hmm.
makes it look at feminism, which is questioning things,
mm-hmm.
suspiciously.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
we need to appreciate the fact that if you are a Christian and you believe in God's word, you need to know that if there's one person who taught by questioning,
mm-hmm.
is the person you follow called Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Jesus taught by questioning.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus got into spaces and things happened because of the act of questioning.
Mm-hmm.
So religion should really be questioned.
Mm-hmm.
And so then feminism needs to recognize the fact that packaging religion as a thing that doesn't question was wrong.
Mm.
Religion is based on let's ask questions. Now, the other side of tension is that in faith, in feminist spaces, people fear a faith because they think faith makes us complacent in our struggle.
Mm.
It makes us look for, you know, the end times that I will have a better home in heaven. I don't need to struggle here. And that is also dangerous
mm-hmm.
because we need to recognize that as Africans and where we are, and we know this very well, religion and faith is very powerful.
Mm.
I say in many spaces that faith or religion convince
mm.
and convinces people.
Yeah.
It brings them together and convince them to think in a particular way,
mm.
convince them to do things in a particular way. The fact that religion is able to convene the masses
mm-hmm.
and to convince them, we cannot
yeah.
ignore religion.
Yeah.
So in faith spaces where we are suspicious about feminism,
mm.
and feminist spaces where people don't want faith,
mm-hmm.
I invite us to come to a place that I'm now saying the next thing about collaboration. I began by saying tension. So collaboration. How do we collaborate? If religion is, if Christianity, for example, is built on Christ who is questioning things, we also need to learn that from Christ and begin to question, why are things the way they are? Why are other people lesser children of God? Why are many people not considered important just because they're women?
Yeah.
We need to ask those questions.
Mm-hmm.
In feminist spaces, we need to collaborate because I said, as you said about Masio Duyoye, that patriarchy is entangled with so many things.
Mm-hmm.
And disentangling it requires that, you know, intersectionality, we remove every layer for us to come to a place where somebody is now fully liberated. And one layer that brings oppression, suppression, and silencing is a layer of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to also be able to disentangle that layer.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is need for collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
With feminist, people who use feminist lenses for their advocacy and for work
mm-hmm.
needs to collaborate with people of faith to be able to disentangle faith aspects that brings oppression.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you will talk about many things
yeah.
and you forget about this one that shapes beliefs and practices
mm-hmm.
and people still remain unliberated.
Yeah.
And finally, I talk about transformation. That what then would be transformation for me? Transformation would be a world that everybody has life in abundance.
Mm.
You may be living in a space where you can't access so many basic things because of poverty.
Mm.
Which we recognize is a problem in many spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But are people having a means
mm-hmm.
to make their lives better?
Mm.
Are people enabled to, you know, go out there and do something with their lives to make their life better?
Mm.
Are people enabled to be who they are authentically and just move out there and try to make life better for them?
Mm.
For me, I look forward to a space where that is a possibility, that no matter where you come from, you have a level of urgency, that you're able to do things to make life better for you. That's transformation. And that also comes from a sense of intersectionality, where if we leave one aspect, then we don't have what we desire as a goal that we call liberation. So from tension, we must come to collaboration.
From
collaboration, we must push ourselves forward to our transformation.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you for putting it in with such nice English. Such nice English. And I keep, like, there's one thing that we've been doing this work on faith and feminism, I keep telling funders and organizers and people who are in the feminist work that we can do everything we do. We can call people Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday for forums and meetings and everything. But the people who have the power to persuade and change people's mind are the people who are with them on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Absolutely.
They are religious leaders.
Mm.
And so not working with religious leaders is really, I would say, is the reason why we're still facing what we are facing.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the reason the rate of gender-based violence is still very high. It's the reason why equality is still very far ahead.
Mm-hmm.
It's because we've not convinced the socio-cultural, religious stakeholders who, as you said, convince. So that power of convincing is not with the NGO.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's with the culture heads and religious heads.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So I'm loving this conversation. Thank you very much.
I also need to come in and say that over time, we don't just have gatekeepers in terms of religious leaders who are gatekeeping spaces where oppression of women, exclusion of women, GBV is enabled. And also, you know, people who are stalwarts of our cultures. For a very long time, we've always been struggling with gatekeepers. What if we change the narrative and looked for gate openers? People who are in religious spaces who would open that space for conversation. People who would open that space for dialogue. People who would open that space for a different conversation an alternative way of looking at things.
Mm.
People in the, you know, NGO world, and as you've said, donors and players in that space,
mm-hmm.
also need to begin to look for
gate openers.
Because
yeah.
there are many.
Yeah.
And many of them are out there. What they lack is, and not so much, but they lack the language.
Mm.
How do we talk about inclusion?
Mm-hmm.
How do we talk about equality and equity, justice and dignity, in ways that resonate with culture and faith or religion or something?
Mm-hmm.
That is what they do not have.
Mm.
They may have a particular way of doing things that then may not look like they are pushing enough.
Mm.
But what if we looked for them in certain place and said, so what do you think justice would look like?
Mm-hmm.
If your Bible says that justice should flow like an ever-flowing stream,
yes.
How should that look like in a context of gender-based violence?
Mm.
How should that look like in a context like Kenya, where femicide is on the rise?
Is on the rise,
yes.
Yeah.
And so if you begin to ask them to package what that means for them today,
mm.
and then you also support doing your language, then justice should look like this.
Mm.
Then there's that collaborative aspect that then we have gatekeepers empowered,
gate openers,
empowered with the language, empowered with the skill, empowered with the information to be able to cause the change that you're looking for.
Mm.
So me, these days, I'm deliberate. I am looking for gate openers. And they are there.
Who has been your gate opener?
One, there are people that I've not even met in person, but I've read their works.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, and I'm deliberate on this, talking about men.
Mm.
One of them is Desmond Tutu,
the
late Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. For me, Desmond Tutu was a powerful gate opener.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who made the world know that from an African perspective, religion can be a space where difficult conversation is done to make life beautiful.
Mm.
I keep saying faith spaces are spaces where things are difficult, things are hard, but everything is beautiful if we begin to ask the right questions. So Desmond Tutu for me would be an example of a powerful gate opener that we have had. And I read his works, I look at the way he did his ministry, and I feel like I would want to embrace that.
Mm-hmm.
I would want to walk in his footsteps. I don't like the idea of, would you fit in his shoes?
Mm.
I mean, you don't need someone's shoes.
Yeah.
You just need you.
Get your own shoes
and do it. So for me, he's a gate opener that I would want to emulate. In our Kenyan spaces and closer home, I have had a chance to interact with women leaders.
Mm.
Talked about Rose Okeno, talked about Emily Onyango, those who are within, you know, the highest positions of leadership in the Anglican Church.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also found people in the academy, in academic spaces, like I found Professor Esther Mombo.
Love. Yeah. I think everyone
yes.
in my conversations know I love Professor Mombo.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to hosting her one of these fine days.
Yeah.
She's very busy, but I will one day have her on this space. Yeah.
Yeah, so I found Esther Mombo. And why I'm mentioning her in this space is Esther Mombo's way of doing things is collaboration.
Yeah.
She asks a question, who is not on the table?
Yeah.
How can we bring them here to do a conversation?
Mm.
And you go to a space and you find people like, okay, so you're also here, like, yeah, I came. And the fact that Esther Mombo's way of doing things is, let's ask the question, who is not here?
Mm.
And how do we bring them here? For me, that is a powerful way of beginning to open gates.
Mm.
And then she brings everybody. She brings those whom we would call gatekeepers.
Mm.
She brings those who would call people in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
She brings people, would say, people who do not have the language.
Yeah.
And brings them to a space where a conversation begins to happen. So I look at her as a gate opener.
Mm.
And I'm looking forward to a time that we would be having as many gate openers. And not just within religious space, but also within cultural spaces.
Yes.
I keep asking myself, who are the custodians of our cultures?
Mm.
Is there this one particular person who would go like, say, bro, it's you.
It's you.
I have realized that we don't have custodians, per se.
What do we have?
We have all of us accepting things that we feel this is our culture, but then we don't critique it.
Yeah. And culture is hard to critique, because then you're told this is what your forefathers used to do. Then you're like, okay, fine. So who am I in this, you know?
But then you also keep saying, like, yes, culture is dynamic.
Yeah.
Why do you want to make it static? And then you keep on making it dynamic.
Culture, we don't accept that culture changes. We don't. I think the changing of culture sometimes is progressive and not immediate, because like when you start an immediate one, there will be tension and there will be opposition. So the progressive nature of it, because that makes it interesting.
And as I've said, for me, I'm looking for who is the prefect of culture. It's us. I mean,
I think it's the, you know, in right now in Kikuyu culture, there's this Kiama. You know, the men who are custodians of culture, who I question, when one day I will sit with them, I will ask them, a whole Mombi with 9 daughters, and women cannot be in the places of worship in Kikuyu culture. That is wrong. That is not right. You think a whole tribe is named after a woman.
Yeah.
The clans are named after women. And then you're saying they can't be where worship is happening. That is lies.
It is. Yeah, I like that example, that there's an organized structure, an organized something that want to peddle a narrative, want to get keep.
Yeah.
And say that this is how things needs to be and things need to move. I think this is in many spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But I like young people.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's not because I'm young, but there's a generation we are calling in Kenya generation Z, Gen Z, everywhere. And of course, I think it's a thing that's happening. I like the way they are questioning things.
Yeah.
And if we are not ready to give answers,
mm-hmm.
I foresee a situation where in the future it will be free for all.
Yeah.
But I don't want free for all society. And a society where conversations are done, a society where possibilities are spoken about, and people can chart different pathways that brings, you know, a mosaic of things.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that this generation has begun to question things needs to tell gatekeepers that the people they are going to hand over are people who
are very hard.
They are
hard to question. So someone told me about, as we are winding this culture conversation, someone told me, you will know that you're in a culture when you die. Because what people do with dead bodies that, like, there are some cultures and rituals and things you only know in times of death.
Yeah.
And so maybe, I don't know what that means.
In terms of death and terms of crisis,
yes.
That's when you see the real claws of culture. That's when you see the real influence of culture. But that's just one side of it. I think every other day, we like it or not, we recognize it or not, there's an aspect of our life that is conditioned by our cultural sensibilities.
Mm.
And sometimes we don't recognize that. But only a crisis provides a space where now that becomes something you really, you know, conscious about.
Mm.
I also pray for a time that it would be the reverse.
Mm.
That it would not be crisis that would make me begin to look at culture.
Yeah.
It would be my everydayness of life, allowing me to look at everything around me differently, looking at things around me in ways that is liberating, ways that open space for everybody, ways that creates pathways for possibilities and living. And that would make culture no longer a boogeyman, but a thing that I would want to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still looking for
who
are the boogeymen
around. I don't know. I think they are hidden. You know how we are told there's Illuminati. There's Illuminati for culture.
Yeah.
So you're a priest and a theologian, as we've said. How would your journey have been if you were a woman? Just think through. I'm combining two questions together. How your journey would have been different if you were a woman. think through some of the women that you are ordained together with. What's different about them? How has their journey been different to yours? And then we are all, this conversation is about the power of female voices and giving power to female voices within faith spaces. What would you say is the hindrance to access to power for women in church? And what do we miss by silencing women in churches?
So I would begin by the first question. How would my, how has my journey been, and how would it be different, or how is it different for women? I see a lot of similarity, but also a bit of difference. Now, I am young. I am unmarried. I am black, and all these kind of things. That already assigns me a level of otherness. Even in faith spaces, sometimes being young is looked at with suspicion in faith spaces. And so I have experienced the aspect of otherness, the aspect of discrimination and exclusion, just simply the fact that being young and married and being black, that has happened for me in many spaces. And through that lived experience, I connect to women in a particular way. Because over time, I've recognized that exclusion and discrimination for women has been so normalized. Until I begin to feel my own exclusion, I'm like, okay, I now feel what they have been feeling. And so coming to a space of ordination, if my ordination would be denied because I was young, I now know what it means for a woman to be denied ordination because they are women. And I would say there is no basis for doing this. But the difference is, as a man, of course, I've always had a, you know, moving easily from one level to the other, basically because as a man, there's an assumption that you are in the right place.
Yeah.
A priest should be a man. A bishop should be a man. A vice chancellor of theology, should be a man. So already you feel like, okay, for my ambitions and dreams as a man, I think it's aligned so well because society...
You're in the right trajectory.
But for women, it's different because then they always have to fight lots of other things before they come to this space where I am. And what we miss, therefore, by not recognizing those realities and silencing those realities, coming back to Matthew Duyoye, Matthew talks about a bird with one wing and not fly.
Yes, I love that image.
And so if we only want to pick palatable realities, we want to only pick narratives from one side of the divide. And I don't subscribe to binaries like there's us versus them.
Yeah.
You know, males versus females. I don't like that kind of ordering. But from us's wisdom, if we don't listen to the realities of women, if we don't listen to the inspiration they also get from the divine, if we don't listen to how they make sense of life, make sense of the of faith, make sense of who God is, then we are missing a very important component of our faith. It is a bird with one wing, which then cannot fly. Secondly, ignoring the voice of women and the power and the place of women in church spaces is in itself making our faith incomplete. Because I read the Bible as a Christian, and I see women evangelists. I see women in leadership in various roles. I see women taking positions to transform societies and do things. And so if we don't recognize that today, then how would we talk about a complete faith? Where we see God using women and God using men. And so we'll miss that completeness of our faith if we keep on ignoring and avoiding women. I want to conclude that section by bringing some aspect that I learned recently. For a lot of times, we have looked at God using male categories. Recently, I began to look at God using all possible categories. I go to the Bible and I see some aspect of God and godness that is expressed in feminine categories. God like a hen covering.
A hen, yes.
God like a nurturing mother. God like a mourning mother. I see that a lot in the Old Testament. I look at like What if we paid attention to some of those aspects of nurturing, some of those aspects of bringing forth life that God is described with the Old Testament? When I began to look at it that way, I recognized that for a very long time, there are aspects of our faith, there are aspects of who God has revealed God's self to us that we miss by ignoring the voice and the faces of women in these spaces.
Thank you. And it's going to battle with half your army.
Yeah.
I don't like army imagery, but it's going to the shamba with a panga that's half. It's, and that's what we are doing when we don't go into spaces of leadership with half the population not there. That wisdom that we are missing is to our own detriment. But I still want to, there's a question you've not answered yet about the, if Adera, if you, at this age that you are, based on your experience, looking at your journey, look at someone you are in class with, a woman, trace your journey and trace theirs. Similarities, you've given us the similarities. What are the differences?
There are women who did not become priests, although they wanted to become priests like myself. A lot of things didn't make that a possibility. I don't know their personal stories, of course, but enough is which we only want to bring onto camera. But I recognize that it has been difficult for them to get to where I am as compared to myself. And I attribute that to the fact that I am a man. Many women have wanted to, and sad, and it's a sad story, many women have died in the doors of ordination. I know my colleague, and may her soul rest in peace, Sister Grace, that died recently with her ordination vestment in her hands, collapsing in the streets of Nairobi and dying at the doors of ordination, looking for ordination over and over for so many years, because she believed God called me, God has empowered me to be in that position. And she was denied that so many times, and it had issues with her mental health. And so she died painfully, and she's not the only one who has died in the doors of ordination. And so really, I know women have struggled to be where I am today. Sometimes I look at myself and my colleagues that I was in class with many years ago, and I am afraid to say I thank God for where I am. Because I see people are where I began with this journey, who are women and where they are today. And a different story. And so you want to say I celebrate, but you want to say that carefully. Because you know someone you began the journey with is not here because of nothing except whether they're women.
You know, one of the most heartbreaking thing, and I'm saying this because I will say this until someone listens to me, one of the most heartbreaking thing I learned about is sex for ordination. Sex for, because one, to get to theological training institution, you need letters. And some of the people who have these letters are men who are custodians. And now these are gatekeepers. And then they say, what will you, if I write you a letter, what will you give me in return? And so some of these women are forced to sleep with the men. And then others are told, if you want me to ordain you or to sign a paper, you have to sleep with me. And that is a silent, it's a silent pandemic that we don't talk about.
We must bring that to the fore.
Yes.
And this is not...
Do you know about it?
This is not stories. I know a lot of stories. I know a lot of situations where women have been asked to give their bodies. And I'm using that deliberately. Just for a pen and paper. That I, okay, how, I want, I need a letter to go to the next level. And they're manipulated to offer their bodies for that. Which is so sad, like, in church, that's happening.
Yeah.
It's so sad in society that women have to give all they have just for signing a paper for them. And it's, as you said, it's not just a silent pandemic. It's a real pandemic.
Mm.
We can see it. We can notice it. And somebody can ask me, then what have you done as Godfrey, as a man?
Mm-mm.
That's why I began by saying I am a feminist and I'm pro-feminism by choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm deliberate that I'm there as a man and a priest. Because I have seen, I have heard, I have noticed,
mm-hmm.
and there needs to be a conversation for a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been willing to do these things in my socials, in my sermons.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about it. Two Sundays ago, one of our readings was about Gideon.
Mm-hmm.
About Samson.
Mm-hmm.
And Samson was born, and then how Samson's mother described, I'd never thought about it until I read it again.
Mm-hmm.
Samson's mother is described as she was barren and had no child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in one sentence, barrenness and childlessness is combined.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, that's
what it's like double like, barren.
Yeah, double barren. I'm like, why must you talk about double barrenness? And so in my sermon, I paid attention to that aspect of describing her situation and overemphasizing her situation.
Mm.
About the story of the woman with the flow of blood, I'm like, she had a name.
Yeah.
Call her by name.
You know, let me tell you one of the practices that I do.
Yeah.
Whenever I find an unnamed woman in scripture, yeah. I give her a name.
Nice. Yeah.
I will never call someone without a name.
And with their situation.
Yes, with their situation. Yes.
And so as a male who is a priest, some of those texts in the
Please
Bible,
be giving them names from now on.
I do.
Yes.
And I question in church, why are they not given names?
Mm.
For example, why are you calling her Jairus' daughter?
Mm.
Why must there be a man to make her visible?
Yeah.
Let's just visibilize them with a man or not.
Yeah.
And as you say, let's give them a name. So for me, it's a conversation. How can we make our pulpits spaces where we can talk about these things?
Mm.
How can we talk about these texts in the Bible in ways that open our eyes, look at our own realities differently?
Mm.
Yeah.
All right. So as we are winding this conversation up, what would you say? I don't know if to call you an ally of feminism, a feminist. Mm-hmm. What has it cost you? And also, as you're saying, what it has cost you, your parting shots, something that you wanted to say that we have not said, please share that with us.
I begin by saying that we are not fighting for people.
Mm.
We are fighting a cause.
Mm.
And it's a worthy cause. We are fighting for a society where everybody, males and females, everybody, young and old, black and white, everybody can be a recipient of abundant life here on earth before we go to what we call heaven.
Mm.
I want them to live life to their fullest here on earth. I want them to be able to get opportunities and spaces to be who they are here on earth before they go to heaven. And how does that happen? How does that come to reality? It comes by asking difficult questions.
Mm.
And so there are people who've been here before us who fought in this cause. And the baton is with us. And the future generations, our children and their children will ask us, what did you do about it?
Yeah.
And so I keep telling people, feminism is like we are fighting for a good cause, a worthy cause.
Yeah.
And we must play our part.
Mm.
We live in a time in Kenya that there is increasing cases of femicides. And just a few are being put on media.
Yes.
But we know there are thousands and thousands of cases of violence against women in our daily life.
Mm.
What are we doing about this?
Yeah.
We must begin to think, we must begin to act differently in ways that we would give our children a different society.
Yeah.
And so it's a cause, it's not people we are fighting, it's not men that women are fighting. We are fighting for our cause for the society.
And it's structural, because also the other thing about patriarchy and the silencing of women is that it robs men too.
Yeah.
And that's one thing we do not understand, that patriarchy dehumanizes men. Because you remember when you began and said that you're a black young man? Mm-hmm. So unless you're an old, rich, white man, unless you fall on those four categories, this world is not structured for you.
Yeah.
And so patriarchy and capitalism go to hand in hand, but also patriarchy robs of men of their ability to be fully human.
Fully human.
Yes.
Yeah. So my parting shot would now be, oh, what has it cost me?
Yes.
It has cost me platforms.
Mm.
It has cost me opportunities to minister. Because there are places you go to and you're labeled a feminist or a pro-feminist. And so that alone gives people room to lock you out. So I've been locked out of spaces and I don't have a problem with that. What I do, I come with my chair. If people say the dinner table, I can't sit on your chairs, I come with my chair.
You can. Or create a new table somewhere else.
It has cost me so many things. But what would I want to say as my parting shot? I would want to invite men like me to come to a place of recognizing that patriarchy has assigned us privilege, but also killing us. And dismantling it is not for the good of the women alone. It's for the good of all of us in the society.
Yeah.
Secondly, I would invite all people who used feminist framings, feminist lenses in their work to also consider that faith is an important component in this work. Faith is an ally in itself.
Yeah.
Before you look at Get Open, as like I said, faith is an important ally. That we miss it, the equation is not complete.
Yeah.
So faith has also resources that can be utilized to push for more inclusive spaces, equality and dignity for women and all children of God. So faith and feminism are not force. They are friends and we can make them work.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. And as Bell Hooks says, as she defines feminism, that feminism is the radical idea, the radical notion that women are people too. And thank you that you have worked and you consistently are theologizing, preaching and working and being active in the front lines, fighting for the humanity of women and the minorities of this country and this nation. So, asante sana, and thank you for coming to this podcast. It has been a great conversation.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening to us. Thank you that you've been in this conversation. Thank you that you've listened to the 6 episodes on this Faith and Feminism series. And as always, as we say, keep doing justice. Kwaheri. Bye-bye.